small but enthusiastic bunch. My name is Frank. I'm an alcoholic. I'm not going to stand here and thump on the podium. I hate people do that. Also, people go like this. Avoid the microphone. That's microphone fear. Let's see. It's a long story, so we should make it till 5 minutes up. We'll see. If not, if I get bored, I'm leaving. So, or fall asleep. Richie said, this guy better be funny. I said, wait a minute. I'm it. We are people who ordinarily would not mix. I haven't been down here since I was a 10-year-old kid when we first came from New Jersey. I come from Hasbrook Heights, New Jersey, where they say yous, not y'all. And I've been living here ever since. You would think that the accent would go, but every now and then it comes out. I was going to wear a suit, but I figured it wouldn't fit in, so I tried to fit in. Right down to the pork barbecue right here. I did. We did an emergency stop on the way down. Richie got hungry, and I was asleep. My drinking started as a kid. I don't know how you all started, but I started as a kid when I was about my first drunk. I don't know about the first drink. The first drinks were like in my grandmother's backyard. I come from I'm an Italian kid lost in an Irish family. Bunch of Phelans, Rafferty's, and O'Briens. My grandmother's maiden name was O'Brien. How I ended up in Eddie, you know, there you are. They wouldn't ordinarily mix either, but they did. And she would have parties in her backyard, and they would drink Knickerbocker beer and wide-mouth bottles before microbreweries were trendy. And my Uncle Pete was a little heavier than me, not much. I don't think anybody's any much heavier than me, but he would... sit in his chair, he had two teeth on the bottom, two teeth on the top, and he would go, here, Frankie, have some beer. And I would guzzle his whole beer as a little kid because that's how I drink. I drink that way to this day, just not booze. Richie still had his coffee when he got here. It's still sitting under his chair. Mine was gone long ago. I guzzle coffee, which I shouldn't drink. I may have to stop halfway through this. The idea is that I drank everything that was put in front of me. And but when I was 10, I have a cousin, had a cousin Vinny. Guy died of bad bladder from too much drug, but he didn't look like Joe Pesci. He looked like a little Irish kid. And we were drinking. I was the kid that they took with them. When they came down to Luray, because I was somebody for him to beat the hell out of, they would say somebody for him to play with, but he loved to beat the hell out of me. And we would come down here, and we traveled together. So when we were up in New Jersey, he decided it was fun to get beer and get the kid drunk. So I got my own quart, I remember it to this day, of Miller High Life, before they had screw-off lids. So when you popped that thing, that was your quart. And... up in D.C. they call them bumpers. I had no idea what they were talking about for a long time. You got a quart of beer, and I drank my quart of beer, and the cliffs over the Hudson River on the New Jersey side are impressive. They're cliffs. And we would go climbing on those when I was drunk. I got a 9-year-old granddaughter, and I think one more year and she's climbing around on the cliffs drunk. Scary thought. Scary thought. I have kids and grandkids. Suddenly the world has to be right. But that was the first drunk I recall, and it was fun, and we didn't get much after that. It took another 3 years for me to get another good drunk going. My father got assigned down to D.C. That's how we got down this area. He wanted to get away from the family connections in New Jersey. He was a very patriotic guy. He was a sergeant in the Army and then whatever the hell they are in the Navy. World War II in Korea, and he wanted to get away from it. So he came to D.C., and we stayed here for a while, and suddenly I was 13. You know, your life comes in. I can't get the chronology right to save my life. There's pictures of me that I've just seen recently that I don't remember being there. It's like that with me. Most of it's hearsay. So at 13, we got on a boat, and we went to Germany, where they know how to brew beer. It's not like the stuff here. It's got alcohol in it over there. And we were assigned to Frankfurt. They had their own brewery, and We drank the local stuff. It was good. And I found out as a young kid, if you could get your little Fennigs up on a bar, that they would serve you. Because we were American kids. We were big, nasty. Most of us were shaving, you know. And so they served us. And I learned how to drink. First time I drank over there, I drank 2 liters, whatever a liter was, of beer. And first I was crab walking again, walking down the street in Germany, drunk kid. Nobody paid any attention, so we went out and did it again. And did it about 3-4 times a week, we would go out drinking. And we drank, they brew a double Bock beer at Christmas time. It's a brown beer, tastes like coffee. It's about 40% alcohol. My God. My first romantic interlude in junior high school, I was on a bus. We had been drinking Steinhager, which is like drinking Zippo lighter fluid. And they had played crack the whip. I don't know how to ice skate. We were ice skating. I don't know how to ice skate. They played crack the whip and threw me through the wall. Through the wall. That's all I remember about the whole incident. But we're riding home on the bus, and I am making out with this young lady. And the kid next to me goes, "Hey, man, she just threw up." And I said, "So what? I'm making out with her. Leave you alone." You got to make sacrifices, you know? You got to make sacrifices. She was drunk and I was drunk. And anything for love. The a theme that pervades my story. The drinking progressed. They had a thing that they made over there. They called it corn. And I said, "What is that?" He said, "I'm going to try it." So we tried it. And it was raw corn liquor. They make it locally here. They make it locally in Germany. I said, "Oh, we're home." So we drank some of that. We drank, chased it with beer. I learned to chase shots of alcohol with beer early in life. I like about 6 shots to 1 beer. It really kind of bumps it up a little bit. The bubbles help a lot. And you don't get as bloated. So that became my drink. Whatever, whiskey and beer. By the time we left Europe 2 years later, there were 6 kids. My mother almost had a 7th child, but she miscarried and she was very upset about it. So we came home early. And I wasn't upset about it. You know, let's get out of here and go home. Europe was boring. I had reached my tolerance level, which was about 12 liters of beer and a few shots, plenty of shots. And I came back here at age 16 with the tolerance. We celebrated my 16th birthday on the ship coming back. To this day, I'd rather take a ship than a plane. I never have cared for flying. There's no wings back there. If you were supposed to fly, God would have gave you wings. The deal is that we got back and we settled in Kensington, Maryland, right outside of Washington. It's a very yuppie suburb now, but then it was right on the fringe of the farms in Montgomery County. And we tried to get some beer. I remember driving up to the D.C. line illegally, driving and drinking to get liquor. We'd send the biggest, hairiest kid in to get the booze, and they'd sell it to him. So we got... We got a case of America's Finest, Champagne. That stuff was awful. You could hold your breath and not pee and still not get a buzz. And it was like 4 of us to a case, so it really wasn't a fair split. And I knew I was in trouble because I needed a drink at age 16. I mean, I needed a drink bad. I was a nervous, weird kid. You know, I was having trouble talking to the girls, and that's always bad at 16. I do this at the home group. I don't know how you all are about it, but it was the 60s. And my brother came home from New York after the first being in New York, and he looked like he was a straight-A student, a little choir boy, solo sopranoist in the choir. He was an altar boy, just a good A student, all-around little Catholic kid. And he looked like someone had plugged him into the wall. His hair was sticking straight out. He had one of those paisley. He had grown a mustache in a week. Grown a mustache. And his eyes were red. And I said, "What's up with you, man?" He said, "Come on down to the farmer's shed with me." And we went down the end of the street, through the woods, down behind the farmer's shed. And he took out this little pipe. put some tinfoil on it, poke some holes in it, drop this piece of stuff in there. And I said, "That's drugs." And he said, the one word that he could have said to me that would have got me to be quiet, which was, "Shh." Now, if you know about Italians, that's the law of omerta. That's silence or death. And he looked at me and said, "Shh," and I shut up. And other people will tell you that they did that stuff and didn't get high the first time. I was shot. I mean, I was stone bombed. And we walked around the neighborhood in the middle of the night. The lights were amazing. The trees were breathing. We ran across about another dozen kids in the same condition wandering up Kensington's little cul-de-sac of drugs and booze. And we found them all. And so we all got together because, we went home to my mother's house and we turned the lights off just to glow. The stereo was all we had. And we listened to the best music I ever heard in my life. I mean, it was good. We wiped out the refrigerator, of course. And we drank beer. I mean, that's what you do. You don't want Kool-Aid when you're doing that stuff. We drank beer. And it worked. I found something else that worked. So it was a dead heat between drugs and booze the rest of my life. And some folks don't like that. They jump up and curse at me in meetings when I say that. But it's true. That's how it was for me. It's the only story I got. I found out that stuff wasn't free. I was shocked. What do you mean it's not free? What happened to peace, love, you know? And he said, no, you got to pay for that. So we got 16 of our closest friends together, pooled our allowance, and we got up $195. And we took that $195 and loaded up in a car with the craziest woman I had ever met in my life. She babbled the whole way out, all the way to Langley Park from Kensington. We were out in the sticks. And we got a kilo of Mexican pot for $195. Nasty dirt weed, but it did the job. We split that stuff up down in the basement. And we were in there splitting it up in the old record top, drinking beer and smoking dope and getting the dog high and just having a good old time. And my mother came down and kicked on the door and said, "I can smell that stuff. Y'all get out of here. I'm going to call your father." They were divorced at the time. They got back together later. My childhood is insane. And so we told her, "F you, you know, out you go," and all that. And about a half hour later, I heard the old man screaming and yelling upstairs and come pounding down the stairs just in time to pick up the record player top. And out the window we went. There were no fences in between the lots then, so I didn't think I could run that fast. And he came through the door with a baseball bat. So we moved out. The story of my life. It was time to move out. And we went to Tacoma Park. And in Tacoma Park, they had one of those social things going on like they had up in New York, like they had in Haight-Ashbury. Tacoma Park is like all the hippies in the world. They're still living there. It's the craziest thing I've ever seen. They're just gray-haired hippies now. And, we stayed there for a while, and my girlfriend kept getting pregnant. And I couldn't figure out how it happened. She was such a nice girl, but she kept getting pregnant. And my father-in-law would get mad at me, want to stand up and fight. I said, "All right, come on. You know, come on." And so she allowed us how we couldn't get in a fight. So the third time she got pregnant, I married her. My father disagreed strongly. My father always disagreed strongly with my life decisions. But that was our relationship. We would scream and yell at each other. My father and I never talked to each other. We screamed and yelled at each other. And he made a good point, though. He said, "How are you going to pay for it?" Into every young person's life comes the day when they have to pay for themselves. And I had not thought of that. I wasn't much on thinking ahead. And so I came up with the decision many of us came up with. I joined the service. because I was going to get drafted anyway, because I had dropped out of college, because we would smoke hash and drink coffee in the morning before going to first period, and you really don't do well. My first period class was sculpture, and I was failing it. So I had to drop out of college, and couldn't concentrate. I found out later everybody was sleeping with the professor. All you had to do was sleep with the professor to pass, but I didn't. I wasn't awake enough to think about that. So I joined the Air Force instead of getting drafted into the Army, and went away to basic training. That was the 6 worst weeks of my life. It is the only period of sobriety I can remember in my life, and I remember it well as torture. I got out of basic training. They sent me an assignment. We went to school in Illinois. I don't like Illinois. We were there in December. They issued us all this stuff and face masks. I said, "What's the face mask for?" He said, "Oh, you'll find out." They would march you across the ice 5 miles to school, and you would drift with the wind. The whole formation would just drift with the wind. I was like, man, we got to get out of here. So they trained us, and you could phase through school, and I phased through. I was the only time I was ever an A student. I want out. So I could do it. Lived up to my potential for the first time in my life, right? I love that. Live up to your potential. And let's see. They let me out of school, and they assigned me, instead of everybody else was going to Vietnam, instead of Vietnam, I'm a Vietnam-era veteran. Never was in Vietnam, so I can't claim that crowd. They're, I respect those guys, but I can't claim to be one of them. They assigned me to the beaches in Tampa, Florida. And you'll find a contingent of our Midtown group down in Tampa, Florida. That was the first assignment down to MacDill Air Force Base down there. And my father, God bless him, tough old Italian guy, took me down there in a car with my brother John. And they didn't like the apartments down there, so they bought me a house. You know, someday I'm going to pay for myself, but it hasn't happened yet. They bought me a house, and they bought me a car, and they moved my then wife down there. So at age, that marriage lasted 1 year. 1 year was all I could sustain it, because I started drinking again as soon as I got out of basic training, and smoking dope again. They didn't test you back then in the Air Force. It was the 70s. And I started drinking and doing drugs, and we got violent, and she kicked me, and I punched her, and I'm not proud of that, but that's what happened. And after having 3 stripes and a house, a wife, a kid, a car, I was a shop chief. I was 21. I had arrived. And I traded it all in to drink and run around at the University of South Florida and sell dope. That's what I do. And so she was smart. She got up and left. She showed good sense. They tell you, explain how you solved your differences in your marriage. We got divorced. That's how we solved our differences in our marriage. She got the hell out of there. And I never remarried for another 20 years. Didn't want to do that again. I did, however, get rid of the house. I couldn't stand being in the house. The memories were killing me. They explained later on in AA that that was resentment. I had no idea what resentment was. I knew I felt bad or I felt good. That was the limit of my feelings. Later on, they gave me a whole list, and they said, if you're feeling this, you're feeling, you know, this. And I was like, wow, newsflash. So I felt bad, so we moved back to Silver Spring, lock, stock, barrel, dog, kid, everything. Moved into an apartment up in Silver Spring, and she threw me out. The woman had common sense. And I launched on yet another phase of my drinking. I moved in with a bunch of dancers from a strip club, and that's where I did the bulk of my my drinking for 15 years. I lived in the strip clubs in D.C. in the basement with the dancers, and that's what I did. I did heating and air conditioning work for a long time. That's kind of environmental systems were my thing on the plane, so I did the air conditioning thing on the residential and commercial buildings. And then my father said, you get laid off every winter, moron. Why don't you get a government job? You have veterans points. So I got a government job working in the government buildings, running heating plants and large chillers and large boilers and stuff like that. And I, you know, boiler jack type stuff. And I did that for many, many years. And at night I would don my pseudo biker outfit and hop in the old Nova and go biker around between three bars. And that was my world. My world shrank to a triangle of three bars where I lived. And that was the limit of my experience. But I managed to stay drunk and I managed to stay high and had my little flings, and my kid got bigger. He ended up in the rooms here. He's got about 12 years now. It's kind of like shooting fish in a barrel. I predicted that he would end up here. The whole thing got pretty bad. It escalated from pot to pot and pills, and I would do, anybody remember Quaaludes? I'd do Quaaludes and margaritas. That was my party night. It would last about 15 minutes. One Quaalude, two margaritas, done for the night. That's it. That was party night. The rest of the time I would run around all night long, making no money. The guy that I got the stuff from tried to explain to me. He says, you're supposed to make money at this. And I looked at him. I said, no, man, this is mine. This is for me. You know, that's why I work, to pay for this. And so I deprived my family of the stuff they were supposed to have. You know, I was a miser. So I had to take care of me. I used to get what my friends would describe as Frank's psychotic breaks. I would just go through little episodes of realizing that they were after me, looking out through the curtains. I lived in the basement, looking out through the curtains. You had to get up on stuff to look out through the curtains. And being fearful of going to the bars and knowing I was being followed around. And turned out I was right. The damnedest stuff happens while you're partying. I'll tell you, I rode around in the car with my little chain wallet and knife and the shotgun in the trunk, and every now and then somebody would come over with a duffel bag full of, here, watch this for me. I'd stick that in the trunk and I'd ride around town with it. Never got stopped for DWI. Always went the back ways, you know, John Wesley Harding, right? The clever little fat Italian crook, right? And so I stayed out of trouble as long as I could. But it was going downhill. I kept staying up all night with the ladies, and so I couldn't go to work in the morning on Monday, or couldn't go to work in the morning on Friday, because Thursday night's a big party night. And I called in sick one Monday morning. My boss called me back and he said, I got you. I have they always document stuff, those people, bosses and cops and, you know, paperwork people. And he said, I got documentation for you missing Mondays for the last year. I'm going to get you fired. I thought, I'm a government worker. You can't get me fired, you jackass. He said, oh, yes, I can, and I'm going to do it. You better get your ass to work. So the old man had given me a brand new car, which of course I had not taken care of, and it wasn't running well. So it was raining, and I jumped on the motorcycle. I had bought myself a little 750 Honda, Joe Biker, right? And took off in the rain for work. I had stuffed my pockets full of goodies, which I sold at work. It was a secure building, so I knew the cops weren't coming in. Right, and the locals loved me, and so we would do a little business at work. And going across to work, I was having trouble negotiating. I don't know, I must have been sleepy or something. You know how it is. And And they had this accident in front of me. Slowing down, I could see, go around. There's no place to go around. It was a creek with rocks there. So I laid the bike down like I'd been taught, but I forgot to get my foot out from under it. And slid in under this. Remember Pintos? Slid in under a Pinto. I'm looking up waiting for the gas tank to explode, right? Went forward, cracked my nose on the windshield of the bike, and found out later on I had crushed 2 vertebrae. I like to say I was 6'5", with curly hair, but you know that's a lie. And slammed the bike in under the car, realized I was carrying, holding stuff, so I had to get out from my, pull the bike out from under the car, crushed vertebrae, couldn't feel a thing, still high. Pulled the bike out, straightened it up, moved it over the side, took everything out of my pocket, shoved it in the raincoat, balled it up and threw it inside my helmet just as the cop was coming over. And he said, "Are you all right?" And I had a little backache and a little headache, but I said, "Yeah, I'm all right. I'm okay." You know, real tough guy, right? Because I knew I couldn't get in an ambulance, and I knew I couldn't get in a cop car. So they took down all the information. He said, "All right, you're free to go." And I rode the bike another 5 miles. I don't know how I did it. Parked in the garage. Did the John Wayne fall off your horse. Crawled around to the building. Went down to the office and stashed it up in the drop ceiling. Raincoat, helmet, and all. I said, if the electricians find it, oh well. But other than that, I'm all right. It's a secured building. And then went up and collapsed in the nurse's office. They took me to the hospital. Kept me for 7 days in the hospital, would not let me stand up. That's how bad off I was. Put me in a, they used to have a crank-up lumbar brace with a pad here and a pad across your bladder and then a big old strip across it, and you cranked it up to pull yourself up straight. And that's what I wore for a year. I went through an addiction with painkillers that didn't work out. Percocets. Dr. Joe, when he got me sober, used to call me a percolator. He says, "Frank, they don't work for you anymore, do they?" I said, "No." He says, "You got a tolerance for that stuff." I said, "Yeah. Everything I do to a point of tolerance where it doesn't work anymore." And I had a prescription for those things, big bottles of them, as needed for pain. Just keep giving them to him, right? The doctor got tired of that. And so I found out that if I took the prescription and took it up to Gaithersburg, Maryland, and traded it off to a lady for some Quaaludes. I love Quaaludes. Traded them to Quaaludes. Took half of those and traded them to another guy for some Redbud pot. Now, you take Redbud pot, and you got to understand, back then, I had Iranian friends when it wasn't popular, like now, when it's not popular to have Iranian friends, right? I always select those people to be my bosom buddies. I can pick you out a bunch of people like that in a minute. And it's like a magnet. If there's a bad direction to go in, I go in that direction. My mother used to say, "Anything but what works, Francis," right? So, I would trade them. They loved Redbud pot. They went crazy over the stuff. And they would trade me opium for it. Now, like I say, I never shot heroin. But smoke some opium? Oh, yes. Smoke some freebase with it? That's Crack's granddaddy, and then drink white port wine by the gallon. My gallon. That's a pain reliever. I couldn't feel anything, much less my back. And so we would do that night after night, and I was having trouble. I'd stay up all night, sleep all day, but I couldn't sleep at night because I had my hours turned around backwards, but the doctor didn't know that. And he said, "You can't sleep at night?" I said, "No, I can't sleep at night for some reason." So he gave me these big, they were about that big, looked like to me, yellow and black sleeping pills. And I'd take one of them sleeping pills, little bike port, no problem, go to sleep. 8 hours in the black hole, right? Get up, start getting high, drinking, smoking. And for some reason, everybody cleared out of the basement. That used to be the party room. I ended up being a one-man party. That was it. No more party. Just Frank in the basement with the pills and the dope and the booze and the nothing. Well, I had brought the shotgun in out of the car because it needed to be cleaned, and I was cleaning the shotgun one day, and I was a little upset, and to the point of tears, and so I stuck the shotgun in my mouth. No, I didn't miss. I changed my mind. I decided I wasn't mad at me. Resentment, I was mad at them. So I shot up the basement, emptied the whole clip into the bathroom, right? And they overreacted as usual. People overreact to that stuff, you know. And they came down and they took me out of the basement and busted up my shotgun, you know, nice, right? And they kicked me out. Poor old Frank, they kicked me out for no reason, right? And so I moved back in with my folks. And if I hadn't died, I'd probably be living with them today. Talk about a failure to launch. I moved back in with them and stayed there. And my mother just about raped. Oh, they gave me my kid back. Anybody who's estranged from their kid, they gave me my kid back. His mother beat the hell out of him one day for drinking all her booze and smoking all her dope. So the cops called me. I was going in for a midnight shift, and they said, come get your kid. And I said, what happened? They said, he's beat bloody. I said, why don't you call his mother? They said, that's who beat him bloody. So I got the kid, and I got him back, and my mother just about raised my kid and me again. And I said, we can't stay here. We can't stay here. We got to get our own place. And they had moved the guy who was selling me my stuff out of his place into what they call the cut-up in Baltimore. It's a maximum security place for, I don't know, some misunderstanding about cocaine. And so I said, well, I'll babysit your house. So I'm babysitting the house, and I got the kid, and my then-girlfriend and I are beating the hell out of each other, so the kid goes back to his mother in spite of all efforts on mine to raise him right. And I'm laying in bed having another one of my psychotic breaks with my back brace on and a little crazy, and the cops called, and I was busted. Insult to injury. And they said, we know you've been dealing dope. We got a big old file on you. We've been following you around. You're not paranoid. You're right. And if we have to come up and get you, it's going to get ugly. So come down, turn yourself in. So I'm real selective about who I picked to defend me. I picked the lawyer who had defended the guy who was then in the Baltimore penitentiary to defend me. Clever devil that I am, right? And he said, no. There's about 75 of you all that they busted downtown in Washington back in 84. He said, you go out and you see Victor Hulon out in PG County. And I'm a nice Montgomery County kid. What do I want with some fly-by-night PG County lawyer? Now, Victor Hulon was a big name in PG County. He ended up, I got a lot of crap about his wife didn't like drugs, so she didn't like me, and she didn't want me around a firm and all this stuff. Victor, about 10 years later, blew his brains out because they caught him with a couple pounds of coke, so ha-ha. You know, don't look down your nose at me. The upshot of it being I got a guy who was about 24th down on the stationery. Some fly-by-night guy with a Mercedes and three-piece suit and about $1 million, you know. And I got him for a defense attorney. I said, all right. He said, did you do it? I said, yeah, I did it. He said, you sure it's not mistaken identity? I said, look at me. There's no mistake in my identity. So he said, okay. How serious is it? I said, oh, it's not serious. Just a little bit. Just a little bit. Well, we went to my arraignment, and he came out of that arraignment. There's nobody in here. Actually, that jacket back there is about the color of his face. Was beet red. And he said, you couldn't tell the truth if you knew what one looked like, could you? I said, I don't know. What's the matter? He said, they've got a file on you. They've been following you for years. They got a file on you about that thick, and they're getting ready to put you in a penitentiary for the maximum time for each one of them four counts you've got. I said, what penitentiary? He said, the federal penitentiary in Lexington, Kentucky. Because you went across state lines, they have upgraded it to a federal, you're now a federal case. They made a federal case out of a few little things in the bars, right? My DDWI, dealing dope while intoxicated. He seemed like a nice guy. And he was a nice guy. He apologized for putting the cuffs on me, for Christ's sake. The deal was, he said that they were going to, it was 15 years for each count. Four counts. And I was 37. I said, I don't think I can do that much time. He said, well, just do what you can do of it. Don't worry about it. Right, so this guy's out of touch with reality, right? He said, Frank, I don't usually do this, but I'm going to open up to you. He says, I'm in another fellowship, the other NA fellowship. He says, and he says, there's two choices that you got. He says, you can either roll over on your friends. They really want you to roll over on your friends and tell them who they are and what you've been doing and give them everybody's name and help them bust them and all that stuff, like your girlfriend that busted you. I thought, I knew she had a resentment. I knew she was resentful. And I said, no, I can't do that, because they took my friend Matt up to a hotel and shot him in the stomach and let him die slow for doing that. So I'm not doing that. He said, well, the other choice is you can walk into the judge, march up there, stand up straight and go, screw you, Your Honor, I did it. And just go to prison. That was the soften up tactic. And you know me, I'm an alcoholic. I said, what's the other choice? Come on, man, there's another choice. That's not good either. So door number three was the choice that I've given. I used to do evaluations at a treatment center. A lot of people frown on that. I enjoyed it for the first year. The second and third year, it got to be a little old. Listen to everybody's sad story. Made me crazy. I'd taken stuff home with me, so I had to stop. But I would give them the same choice that was given to me. You're either a criminal, family business kind of guy, right? You know where you go if you're a criminal, right? Go to jail. Or you're sick. I said, what do you mean sick? He says, you know, drug addict, alcoholic, that type of stuff. He says, those people get to go to meetings, and they go to treatment, and they go to wherever you got to go to do whatever you got to do to get better. He says, and then you live a good life. I said, no jail. He says, I didn't say that. He says, I said, you get to live a better life. Or you can just go to prison. Now, when I used to give this talk, I used to say I'm sick, not stupid. But I found out through several inventories I'm both. But I'm not that stupid. So I said, I'll take the treatment. And they sent me to a guy up in Kensington. I don't know if any of you all know Dr. Joe Chambers, but he was big in Kensington at the time. And he did strange stuff. I mean, they put me in detox for one day. Right? I realized that not everybody goes to detox for one day. I went to detox for one day just to make sure I wouldn't do the fish flop in the meetings on the floor in his treatment center thing that he had me go to. And so that's how I know when my sobriety date is. And that's September the 29th of 84. It's on a wristband. That's how I know when that is. And other than that, I got no claim to fame for it. They put me in a recovering physicians group. I said, I'm not a doctor. What's up with that? He said, well, you talk like a trash can, and they talk like computers. Maybe you'll meet in the middle, and we'll get some honesty out of y'all. So I'm supposed to bust out the doctors, right? And the doctor said, what kind of doctor are you, Frank? And I said, I'm Dr. Detroit. That's who I am. And so we step outside, son. So you dock your butt around the house. And so we got to some truth. And that was all good, but they never sent me to AA in any of those treatments. And I, to this day, wonder why, but they didn't. I had some bad experiences with that group. I had one dentist tell me that he never went to meetings. He said, I go to two maintenance meetings a week. And I'm fine. And I thought, damn. You know, this guy's been trying to get me to go to all these meetings. I'm not going to them because this guy's... So I didn't go. And I was crazy as hell. And I went back. I was going to kill him. Two maintenance meetings a week, right? He lied to me. So I went back in and I sat there and waited and it started to start. And I said, whoa, 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 what's his name? And he said, you mean jackass? He's back in detox. He never stays sober. Don't listen to him. So you got to pick out somebody to listen to in here. The guy finally drew the line with me. He says, you've got to go to one meeting. And I'll write a letter to the court to you. You walk on water. You get off scot-free. You're not an alcoholic. You can do it. No problem. You haven't drank. You haven't done no drugs. I've been testing you. No drugs, no drinking. You might be right. I told him, I got this thing, man. I didn't tell him about still working at the bar. I had traded in the government career for a job down at one of the bars. I was the weekday night doorman, and on Saturday night I was your sober, alcoholic, addicted bartender at the strip club. I didn't tell him about that. So, and then they'd have me cook too during the week, during the day, because they were trying to be nice to me. I had lost my career. I had traded it in for this job, right? And when he found that, he said, Frank, you couldn't find another $7 an hour job besides that. I felt like I should have paid them for that job, but, you know, that's another story. The ideal was that I still like what I like. Where was I going with this? Oh, he wanted me to go to one meeting, and I'd have got off scot-free. You would think, right? The book talks about it. We run our affairs right up to the one arrangement that we have to make, and then you might as well just shoot us and tell us we only got to do it once. So I'm supposed to go to this meeting. It was his 10th anniversary. I was supposed to go to his 10th anniversary celebration. Somebody was going to get up and talk for him like this, and he wanted me to hear it. He was all in for me succeeding in life. And I went to work that day, and it was a terrible day. The girls were misbehaving, being, you know, how they can be. And the cook that I was working with was mad at me because I wouldn't sell him dope no more. I was getting all that don't step on my foot stuff in the kitchen, right? So I got off of work, and I sat down, and I said what I always said. I'll just have one beer. One beer on the eve of walking out clean, right? Well, you know what happened. 6 beers later, I decided to have my little treat, which is a half a gram, one line, all up one nostril for me. He was right. I hadn't done anything. I hadn't drank anything. I hadn't done any dope. And man, oh man, did I lose my tolerance quick. Sometimes you can drink a lot, and sometimes you just do a little bit. And I started shaking, and I started sweating, and my stomach started cramping. And I said, he's right. I can't stop. Oh, my God. I said I had this thing, but I can't stop. And I went back the next Saturday to the recovering physicians group, and I said, I did it. I blew it. He said, where were you? I said, I drank. I figured, you know, brave and honest, tell the truth. He'll give me another chance. He shook that ham hot fist in my face. Big guy, right? Covered my whole face with it. He said, you couldn't tell the truth if you knew what one looked like. Get out of here. You're going to treatment, and you're staying in treatment forever. I don't want to hear nothing else out of you. So they threw me in treatment, and I stayed in there and got out of there and went to AA. And I don't know what happened at those meetings. I went to, it was the 15th anniversary of the St. Martin's group up in Gaithersburg, and they were having a dance afterward. And I thought, you know, it would be a dusty little room with a bare light bulb and a bunch of guys sitting around in trench coats smoking cigarettes. And some of meetings were like that, but not this one. They had suits on and evening gowns, and they had covered dishes with food in them, which is always a big sell with me. I was, one of my big fears in sobriety was that I was going to starve to death in sobriety. That's funny. And they had the food, and they had the dance, and somebody invited me to get up and dance sober. I informed them that I don't dance. I watch people dance. I don't dance. But I got up and danced sober and started recovery, and we had a good time. And the guy that did the meeting spoke, and he said, you know, there's 30 of you in treatment. He says, 29 of you ain't going to make it. One guy's going to make it. And I felt like jumping up in the balcony going, me, me, who, me? It was me. Through no grace of my own. That's the grace of a higher power. Because I'm telling you, I wouldn't have given you 50 cents for the stuff that I did early on in recovery for me staying sober. I held on to that job until my first anniversary because I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't tell anybody what I was doing. New people do weird stuff, man. Weird stuff. And for my first anniversary, they locked the place down afterwards and they had a party for me. Woohoo! Way to go, Frank. 1 year, nothing. Way to go. And the guy that ran the place cinched it for me. He came over and he said, "You did it, man. You got 1 year sober. Have some stuff. Have a line." And I could smell it. And I'm that close. I'm that close. And I said, "Got to go in tomorrow and do urine analysis. Better not. And by the way, I got to get up early to do it, 11 o'clock in the morning." I said, "Would you mind letting me out?" He said, "No, no." And he opened the door and I walked out real slowly and ran down the stairs, got in the car, drove home, hid under the covers. And I said, "My God, I got that close. I will never go back there again." And I've never gone back again. Quit the job, got a different job. I went and told, I didn't talk to you guys for the first year. I don't know how long you can hold out without talking to people. I can hold out without talking to people for a long time. I'm an isolatory, nasty person by nature. And so people don't want to talk to me. My sponsor said, "You're hard to hug, Frank." And I said, "You know, I was talking to one lady in AA. Thank God for the ladies in AA. Because she would put up with me and talk to me. And she was a little shady lady, too. I liked her. So if I liked her, she wasn't right. The deal was that there wasn't nothing wrong with her. She was a good girl. She stayed sober till she died. And she said, "What are you doing down there doing that? Talk to your sponsor about it." And I said, "I don't have a sponsor." She said, "What did you say?" I said, "I don't have a sponsor." And she called me a name that they still call me. And she said, "Look, asshole. You either get a sponsor or I'm not going to talk to you anymore. I'm not putting up with this." There goes my whole support group, right? In one shot. I said, "Okay." I had been going out I accidentally stumbled into a Saturday night meeting where there was a guy. Now, I was on food stamps when I got here. Welfare and food stamps. That's how bad it had gotten. And they wouldn't buy cigarettes for you. And I smoked cigarettes big time back then. And I would sit next to this older guy in an AA meeting on Saturday night, and he would let me bum cigarettes from him. That was Mike. And Mike and I would have contests filling up the ashtrays with his cigarettes, which I thought was great. I wanted what he had. He had cigarettes. He was driving a big old black Lincoln at the time. Had himself a nice pretty girlfriend. You know Mike, always a pretty girlfriend, right? And I can't see any deeper than that. I'm new, right? Brand new. I just want material stuff. Never mind, do you want what we have? I just don't want to go to jail, you know? I just want to have a cigarette, for Christ's sake. And I said to him, I need a sponsor, Mike. And he said, "Can you follow directions?" And I hadn't seen that in the literature anywhere. So I said, "Well, under certain circumstances, I guess." And he called me the pet name. He said, "Look, asshole, it's a yes or no question." And I said, "Yeah, I can follow directions, smart guy, because if it don't, I'm going back out and drink. How do you like that?" And he almost fell on the floor laughing at me. And he said, "I'll tell you what, if it don't work out, you can go back out and drink. How's that, smart ass?" And I said, "Damn, what happened to loving you till you could love yourself?" He was different. He was different. Everybody else was all touchy-feely, weird, but he was about, you know, going places, like meetings. And we're going to meetings like three a day, four. That's like, other people ain't doing this stuff. What's this three a day, four a day? So he said, "Shut up. Get in the car." The spiritual message. Shut up and get in the car. Okay, you're the sponsor. And drive. I had to drive, right? So I'm driving the Lincoln around, right? I got what I wanted, right? I'm driving the Lincoln around. I'm driving him around. And he tells me, "Be at my house at 9 o'clock on Saturday morning." Now, who goes to bars at night? There's no such thing as 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning. There's no place to go. So I, outside of my experience, I show up dressed up, right? Black leather jacket, greasy black t-shirt. You can't tell it's greasy, but it was. It smelled bad. Chain wallet with knife, little dirty jeans, and motorcycle shoes, right, with steel toes. I'm ready to go. We're dressed up to go out. And he says, great. We get in the car. At that time, I had long, greasy hair, too, and a beard. And we get in the car, and we drove up to Hagerstown to the first Mickey Paw. I think we listened to Cliff Roach. You were listening to Cliff Roach the other day? I thought, this guy's insane, right? That was later. We get to Hagerstown, and it's pouring rain. I have my leather jacket on. He says, drop me off at the door and go park the car. And be careful where you park it. Don't get the door banged. And I tell him what I always tell my sponsor, yes, Mike. And I go park the car and walk my wet, dreary rear end back. This is going to be fun. I guess it was 10:30 by then, right? I'm ready for a nap. And I walk in. Again, thank God for the women in AA. This girl jumps up out of the pool, and she's my kind of girl. Just softy, right? Huge girl. Comes bounding over out of the swimming pool with her wet bikini on. I'm already wet, so I don't mind. She throws herself around me, kisses me on the cheek, and says, I'm so glad you're here. And I thought, Christ, I'm glad I'm here too. Puts a pin on me. I figure we're pinned, right? It's happening, right? It finally happened to me. And she said, I'll talk to you later. I said, you bet. And I looked down at the button. It says, misery is optional. And I thought, is it that obvious? Is it that? I must have looked like a drowned rat and smelled like one too, you know? And we stayed at that conference against my better judgment. We saw the Muppets. So exciting. The Muppets and coffee. I finally arrived, right? We heard Cliff speak, which I thought was good. He was a surfer dude. I admired them. And then they had another one of them damn sober dances. And Mr. Hard Guy says, come on, this ain't a stand. Dance. Get out there and dance. So we danced, right? And we stayed up there overnight and then came home. And it was like that. We would go places like Iki Pa. I said, what's that? You get something on your paw? What's that? He said, that's the International Conference of Young People in AA. I said, I don't know if I can tell you this, boss, but me and you ain't young people. He said, I am. I don't know about you. And we went out to, we were supposed to go to Miami. Sunlight of the Spirit in 86. I said, you mean fly? He said, yes, fly. Get permission from your probation officer. Now, I was on federal probation for 3 years under a guy named DeLash. So under DeLash, if you've read the book, right, I stayed sober. And I went in and I asked Mr. DeLash if I could go to Iki Pa on Key Biscayne. He said, Frank, I'm going to send a convicted cocaine dealer to Miami for AA conference. Sure I am. No, you can't go. So I went back. I said, I don't have to go. He says, you'll go under an assumed name. Don't worry about it. So it was like getting a cat in a bathtub. He got me in the airplane and his girlfriend held my hand all the way to Miami. See, I wanted pretty young things to hold my hand. I got what I wanted again. And we went to the Sunlight of the Spirit, and it was great. And I'm here to report that I didn't get busted while in Miami. Didn't snort any cocaine at the AA conference. Just wasn't there. Didn't drink anything. They weren't serving it. But we had fun. We did another sober dance, you know. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous watching me dance. It looks like Bill Cosby. The culmination of my story is the high point of my sobriety. I got married again. Little old fat guys in AA find love too. I couldn't believe it. She's perfect. Year and a half clean in NA, just sick as hell. I loved her. And we ended up getting married about 4 years later. I waited. I waited as long as she'd wait. And we went to Hawaii for an AA conference. She said, we're going to the conference anyway. We're living together. Why not get married there? And I screwed her up. I said, yeah. Then she got nervous. And we got married on in Ala Moana Park. The guy at the conference said, Ala Moana in Hawaiian is where the moonlight hits the water. It's just like that. It's diamond lights when that moonlight hits the water there. It's on Magic Island under a banyan tree. We had then Midtown, 60 people, at our wedding in Hawaii, which I understand is unusual. And there's a video of it. Me getting married again. My sponsor was my, he gave the bride away. My son was my best man. And my wife was gorgeous. We wore leis, flowers. You know, they did the thing in Hawaiian and English. And it's just, and it lasted. It lasted beyond lasting. You know, it's just one of my favorite AA memories. And so, I don't know how much better I am. I can't tell you. If you can't see it, they asked my kid, how can you put up with him? He's so obnoxious. And he said, he used to be a coke dealer. It was really bad in the old days. So I guess it's better. And life is good. I guess if there's any message, it's that if someone who screws it up as bad as I did can stay sober in AA, anyone can stay sober in AA. Thanks for letting me share.